everyone from Prepare for Change. I am Meg, coming to you from the USA, and my interview partner is Richard.
Hi there, I'm talking to you from the UK.
We at prepareforchange.net are pleased to be back. We'll make a few announcements and then we'll get started.
At Prepare for Change, we post information pertinent to awakening the community with the truth and to get people ready for the event. We have new articles on our website every day, so check us out. Why not sign up for our daily newsletter? This can be found at the bottom of each article as a little mail icon in the sharing box. Also, we have a humanitarian project in Malawi, Africa, which is supporting an orphanage currently hosting around 300 children. These children have unfortunately lost their parents to wars, starvation, disease, and other unfortunate events. We are helping them build dormitories, plant gardens, source healthy food, clothe themselves, and of course go to school.
If you would like to donate to Prepare for Change or to the Malawi Project, please go to prepareforchange.net and click on the donation button. Here you can make donations via PayPal, credit or debit cards, cryptocurrencies, or you can send checks to our mailing address, also listed on this page. To all of you who have donated in recent years to PFC and the orphanage, we continually thank you from the bottom of our hearts. This is really making a difference for the children in Malawi. Okay, so let's get started. Hi, today at prepareforchange.net, we are interviewing Benjamin Fulford. Benjamin's website is benjaminfulford.net. We would like to introduce Benjamin to our listening audience. Benjamin is a reporter and investigative journalist. He's been a correspondent for several news organizations in Asia, and notably, he was the Asia-Pacific Bureau Chief for Forbes magazine. He left Forbes in 2005, somewhat in disgust over their editorial direction and censorship. Benjamin's weekly reports are based on information from a broad range of sources, including, among others, the Japanese Yakuza crime family, the British Intelligence Service, MI6, the Freemasons, the CIA, the KGB, and the Mossad. Benjamin's weekly geopolitical news reports provide updates and summaries of the latest events in the ongoing secret war for control of planet Earth. Benjamin's website at benjaminfulford.net is completely independent and subscriber supported. Hi, Benjamin. We're delighted to have you here today with us.
Hi. Well, thanks for having me on.
Great. Would you like to add anything to that biography I just read?
Well, the only thing is that, you know, I have to say that in addition to being a journalist, I'm actively trying to overthrow a group of criminals who hijacked power in the West and who are, you know, mass murderers and psychopaths and should not be in power.
Agreed.
Okay. Well, good. We'll add that to your bio then.
Okay. We'd like to start today with very big news of North Korea and South Korea reunifying. Benjamin, you have been talking about the reunification of the Korean Peninsula for a long time. Can you talk to us in general about how you see this as a person so experienced with Asia politics?
Okay, now, remember, I've been reporting out of Tokyo for about 30 years. And for most of that time, I believed what most people believed, which is that North Korea was a rogue state. And I remember having a scoop in Forbes that they had, you know, developed a nuclear weapon. And it was only after I met someone from the Chinese intelligence who told me that they thought of North Korea as an American colony that my whole sort of perspective started to change. And then since then, I've talked to members of the Japanese royal family and to North Korean. I had a North Korean spy girlfriend for 2 years, which is a whole thing we'll get into sometime, but not today. Anyway, talking to a lot of and CIA types, you know, like the people who run CIA in Southeast Asia, all sorts of people like that. And I started to realize that it was not what we're being told. And that, okay, North Korea was founded by members of the Japanese military government who when they saw that Japan itself had been occupied by the Americans, they said, well, there's no point going back to Japan. So they decided to rebuild the Imperial Japan in North Korea. So the system they have is very similar to the system Japan had, during and before World War II. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to keep themselves independent by balancing China, Russia, and the U.S. against each other. But now we fast forward to 1992, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the East Bloc collapsed, and they lost 40% of their GDP in like 1 year, with all this, Russian stuff stopped coming. And they went to the Americans for help. And at first, under Clinton stuff, they were transferring nuclear technology. This was open, this was in the newspapers, this was not secret, this was on the front pages of all the papers, so that they could become energy independent. And I guess that then the plot changed with the Bush neocon people, who decided that it was more convenient to have North Korea as a rogue state so that they could use it to sell weapons. I think a U.S. ambassador to China once sort of said in public that if North Korea didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, like a good example is they transferred this Taepodong nuclear technology to the nuclear, or not nuclear, I'm sorry, missile technology to North Korea. These are like old Cold War, missiles of the sort that the U.S. knew how to shoot down because they're, they're old and dated. And so then they say, all right, now shoot one over Japan, right? Mm-hmm. And then they go to the Japanese and say, oh my God, you got these North Korean crazies shooting missiles at you. And guess what? We have these things called Patriot missiles. They're perfect for Taepodongs. They're a little bit expensive, but, and so they're using them as an arms sales publicity stunt, whatever. And the other thing that if if a lot of people, they're so drowning in the daily mass of news that they lose a long-term perspective. A good example is for about 30 years, or no, since 19, let's say 20 years, they've said that soon, North Korea will have nuclear missiles that will be able to hit Alaska or Hawaii or, something like that. And they kept repeating the story. But if we think about it, they launched a satellite in 1998, which meant that at that point, they could hit anywhere on Earth. Mm-hmm. Okay? But nonetheless, they keep telling this BS story that soon, just like for 30 years, they're telling us that within 2 or 3 months, Iran would have nuclear weapons and we had to do something about it, right? Mm-hmm. For 30 years, they're saying in 2 or 3 months. It's just, and people, I don't know. I guess they lost their ability to think, or they're just, I don't know what happened, but somehow we lost the plot. So what's happened is that Trump came in like a bull in a china shop trying to, well, what's going on here? And he started out saying, well, if they're bad guys, let's get them. And then, they say, actually, Mr. Trump, it's not really quite like that. And so, anyway, the bottom line is, okay, so why don't we just unify? And I was actually involved in negotiations at an early level, and the Chinese told me that they didn't mind if U.S. troops stayed in a unified Korea so long as they stayed south of the 38th parallel, which is where, they fought a bloody war, and like lots of Chinese died to get that line, and lots of Americans died. So I said, okay, this is where we fought to the death and got to a stalemate, so let's just leave the status quo. And the Americans will stay to make sure that Korea is independent from China.
Okay.
So it was a good deal. And the next question now is going to be Iran. Mm. And again, because I have primary sources, so I've talked to two of the children of the former Shah of Iran. They both told me the same story, that during the Bush era, the Bush administration gave them weapons with neutron bombs. These are ones that kill people but leave buildings intact. And mm-hmm. Say, why don't you go ahead and use them against Israel, And of course, If the Iranians sort of said, no, we don't think so, you know, because they knew that it was a trap. They do that, and then the Americans have an excuse to just, you know, totally obliterate Iran. Mm-hmm. So during the Obama administration, they said to Obama, hey, you know, we've got these missiles. We don't want them. Do you take them back? And the Obama administration pretended they didn't know what was going on and wouldn't take them back. Now, there's another story that people don't know, speaking about the Middle East, was that the whole question of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Okay? Here's the thing. Before the Bush administration invaded Iraq, they knew that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. The reason they knew it is because they sold them to them. Right? So they know, we sold you these weapons, so we know you got them. But what happened was, before the Americans invaded, they went to the Iraqis went to the Iranians and said, look, do you mind, you know, keeping these things for us while the cops come, you know, so that they don't, you know. And they moved all their weapons of mass destruction into Iran. Mm-hmm. That's why they were never found, right? So it's, well, how come there's no weapon, you know? And it was a big loss of face, you know. And then the average brainwashed American soldier who thinks he's trying to protect innocent people from weapons of mass destruction saying, hey, they lied to us. We're fighting for the wrong reason. And that sort of helped wake a lot of these people up, which is a good thing. But anyway, I ramble on. So you have other questions?
Well, well, just to follow up on the Iran situation, I mean, we also have Israel calling out Iran. So isn't this the kettle calling the pot black? Because Israel has had nuclear weapons for some time also. I mean, what do you know about that? What can you tell us?
Yeah, of course they've had nuclear weapons for, you know, everyone knows they got at least 200. And they've always talked about their SAMSUM option, which is that if anybody tries to destroy Israel, they take the world down with them, you know. But the real thing, again, you know, this is, I say stuff when I have reason and facts behind me. And the weirdest thing for me was when I confronted Japanese former finance minister, Heizo Takanaka, about handing over control of Japanese corporations to these hedge funds who were controlled by, you know, the usual suspects, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, all these oligarchs. And I was actually, and I have this on tape, you know, I was offered the job of finance minister of Japan as long as I go along with a plot to kill 90% of humanity, because they want to save the environment and they want to get rid of what they call useless eaters, people who, you know, destroy the environment and don't actually make things in factories, you know. And they say they're going to do it using starvation and disease. And yeah, once the Bush regime was in place, they paid huge subsidies, central bank money, to farmers to grow a fuel instead of food. And they had a food crisis in 33 countries. And then they were spreading, you know, bioweapons like weaponized bird flu, Ebola, SARS, etc. So there was an actual attempt by the people behind the Bush regime to kill 90% of humanity. Now, how does this connect to Israel? Well, you know, again, I got this from primary sources. I'm a reporter. If it appears in writing or in a video, it means somebody has beaten me to the story. My job is to get stuff out there for the first time ever. Otherwise, I'm not doing my job. I'm just, you know, regurgitating someone else's work. But having said that, I sort of did the background research, and I came to this guy called Sabbatai Zev, who was in Turkey in around the 1600s, and he said he was the Messiah. And his belief was that it was up to the Jews to carry out the prophecies. They shouldn't wait for the Messiah or God to do it. It was their job to make this happen. And he was taken in by the Sultan, and who said, look, you say you're the Messiah. All right, well, you can prove it by you know, stopping these arrows, or else you're going to have to convert to Islam. So he pretended to convert to Islam. And what we've then seen is we have this group of people who pretending to be Muslims, pretending to be Christians, pretending to be Jews, who are involved in this incredible plot to carry out biblical prophecy, which involves having these two giant countries, Gog and Magog, kill each other and destroy 90% of humanity. And then the other 10% would become slaves of the people who carried out this plot. And this was also revealed by Benjamin Friedman after the Cuban Missile Crisis. By the way, I was living in Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was a baby, but my father was a diplomat there, and my mother was friends with Che Guevara. But, you know, they came very close to destroying the planet at that time. And this guy, Benjamin Friedman, said, yeah, they've got this crazy plot to you know, carry out Armageddon and biblical prophecy. And, of course, the real Jews were saying, no, we don't. God does God's work. We don't do it. And so a lot of the people who were opposed to this project were the people who were killed in the Holocaust, including, you know, my mother's grandfather's family, were saying this is ridiculous. And so there's still a split between the religious Jews who think this is nonsense and these, you know, fanatical Zionists trying to carry out this end of the world scenario. So we've seen it over and over again. They tried to start World War III with North Korea. They tried to start it with between China and Japan. They've been trying, you know, with Iran and Israel forever. And they're still trying now, you know, and that's what we're seeing. So Israel is under the control of a group of fanatics who aren't actually Jews, you know, who are heretics, who are trying to artificially, you know, carry out Armageddon. It's crazy. It's just so out there. You think this can't be, but the overwhelming evidence is that these are the actual people in charge. And these are the people we've been trying to remove from power because they're mass murdering nutcases.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
I was going to say, so you mentioned Gog and Magog, and I've heard these terms thrown around before. I mean, would you be able to expand on that specifically? Is there any particular nations you would consider Gog or Magog?
I think an Israeli newspaper, I know an Israeli newspaper once reported that the G7 would be Gog, and then Russia, China, Iran would be Magog, you know, because they have to be equal enough that they can kill each other.
Yeah,
that's why, for example, they give weapons and stuff to the Iranians because they don't want it to be a one-sided fight. They want to make sure that they each have enough to kill each other, you know. But they've before that it was the Soviet Union versus the West, right? The communism, capitalism. But they keep trying to do this stuff, you know. And the Chinese, they keep saying, you know, these Westerners with their silly zero-sum games, you know. And I don't think the zero-sum game doesn't really convey to a lot of people what they're talking about. What they're talking about is they only want a scenario where there's a winner and a loser. Mm-hmm. Like futures markets. Everybody who makes money has a counterpart who loses money. But it's the total is zero.
Yeah.
And so, you know, invading countries taking their stuff, they lose what you get. You know, this sort of behavior is antisocial and it's not a way to run a country or a planet. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying, instead, let's do something we all agree upon, that we all think is good, that benefits us both. And that's the sort of paradigm we're trying to shift to, away from these, you know, wackos. And then of course, we have the military-industrial complex. And now, these are very powerful people with big weapons and stuff and a lot of money involved. So you have to buy these people out. You can't pick a fight with them, okay? It's just not the right way to go about it. So you say, all right, we'll give you even more money, but you'll do, you know, space exploration and other things other than, you know, killing people and stealing resources. And they've sort of agreed, I think, most of them. So, you know, we're slowly shifting, but these people still control the governments of, you know, Israel, France, England, Germany, and they're sort of fighting over the U.S. So it's not over, and it's like a war, and they're losing, but they're still very powerful. It's not over. That's, you know, but You know, I was never, you know, I was, when I was a child, my parents told me, don't look at the Bible, just stay away from that, you know. I was never involved in this stuff until I actually got invited to participate, you know, by someone linked to the finance ministry of Japan. And only then did I start doing the research, you know, and realize that, you know, we have these religious wackos who control the money printing machinery, which is the source of world power. Mm. And what's happening now, too, is that there is a faction that was the global warming faction that were actually much more moderate. They're saying we don't have to kill 90% of the population to save the environment. We just put a tax on carbon. Mm. And these people are saying, okay, well, now that we've got rid of these World War III guys, we're in charge. But, you know, nobody elected them. And okay, so we had a common enemy, but, you know, their whole global warming carbon thing is a lie.
Yeah.
You know, why don't you tell the truth? Say, we want to save the environment. We want to end poverty. Why do you have to make up a bullshit story? And the reason is because they want to get all that money. They want the control. They want to, you know, they still want to be the God kings of the planet. But again, nobody elected them, and they're doing it in secret, and they're not being very competent.
Right, right. So it on a more benevolent group out of all these that you've just been talking about, that you've talked about a lot, is the White Dragon Society. So we'd like to ask you about them, because they seem to be this very positive counterpart to all this. And but to us in the West, the White Dragons are a new concept. So can you tell us basically who they are?
Well, what happened was when I started warning the around the time that SARS was released, and I found out it was a bioweapon that was targeted to kill non-white people, or, you know, they came to me, the Asian secret societies, like the Red and the Blue and these other big, powerful groups. And they asked me, well, can you find people in the West who you know, would work with us, right? So, there were all sorts of people in the Western power structure. For example, the U.S. Marines, who, if you remember, Smedley Butler, who was offered the job of president by grandfather of Bush, Prescott Bush, and by the Rockefellers and stuff, if they would overthrow Roosevelt. And instead, he wrote a book saying war is a racket, and said, I've been, you know, invading countries for banana companies and stuff like that. Anyway, there's a group there in the U.S. military concentrated on around the Marines who said, you know, we're supposed to be the good guys. We're not, you know, we didn't sign up to be the bad guys. And then there are people in the British intelligence, like the old British Empire types, who said, yeah, you know, we're supposed to be the greatest good for the greatest number, you know. And Japanese people in the intelligence and the military intelligence, you know, came up, and then people from the Russian FSB came. So it's like it snowballed. There's all these people in the West who said, yeah, we were supposed to be the good guys, whatever happened. And so it kind of like mushroomed like that. So the White Dragon is a very nebulous sort of cover for this wish that we, you know, once again be the good guys and remove the criminals from power. And you know, what I've told the Asians about the West is that you can think of it like a beautiful woman with syphilis. You know, you find it very attractive, but if you get too close, you're going to regret it later, right? And so you got to make sure she takes her antibiotics first, you know, and.
Specifically, I do want to ask you about the White Dragons, because it's a very curious group to us. You know, aren't they ancient Chinese families? That's what we've sort of vaguely understood.
There is an ancient Chinese group called the Bai Lung, which is White Dragon in Chinese. And there are these dragon families, but this includes the Merovingian kings. It's not just, apparently the royal families from around the world have been intermarrying and have known each other for a long time. So it's the old royal bloodlines. And they're, you know, there are different groups within that. There's the red, which is sort of the, I guess you'd call it the, you know, the old Ming bureaucracy and the Ming royal families and stuff, and then the Song and other old royal families. There is the blue, which is sort of like the Persian, Middle Eastern royal families, I think. And the white would be like the European. But the other thing is that there was something called the Black Dragon Society. And at first, I thought maybe, you know, the Black Dragon Society would be the one that would do it. But as I looked into the history of the Black Dragon Society, I realized that they were kind of anti-European. And it was sort of like, we got to overthrow the white people type of sort of thinking behind that. This was the people behind the greater Asia, East Asia co-prosperity sphere in World War II. So it wasn't quite the right, you know, grouping. And the white dragon is also is related to a legend. There's a goddess in Japan called Benten, who they have seven gods of happiness, and one of them was this female goddess, well, there's a goddess Benten who, you know, is responsible for fertility, music, education, you know, female type things. And there's a legend that there's this huge sea monster. That was terrorizing people, and she convinced it to instead become a protector of the poor and the weak, and that was the white dragon. So I thought it was a good metaphor for the military-industrial complex.
Interesting. Okay, so speaking of China, there's been a number of different things that have come out of China recently. You reported about this new sensor network in the South China Sea. There's a new imaging network that's gone across the country that can scan up to 1 billion faces per second. And it's becoming quite public in Western media. They are cracking down on people's travel and ability to move freely, especially if they're not conformist to the regime. What do you make of China at the moment, and especially Xi Jinping's steering and direction of it?
Well, you know, overall, I mean, China has managed to, you know, lift more people out of poverty in a shorter time than anyone else in human history. We've got to give them credit for that. And, and they have a system which is, they copied from the Japanese system they had until the Americans forced the Japanese to dismantle it. And also similar to the system that Singapore used, which was an improved version of the Japanese system, which is, you know, you have a future planning agency staffed by really competent people who say, well, how do you want to be 5 years from now? What kind of country do you want to build? And so they were able to agree on, you know, building up infrastructure and housing. And now they're going for, you know, environment. They finally realized that pollution is really bad. I mean, and so now they're becoming very eco. So I give them really good points on that. But as far as this, you know, trying to turn everyone into a single conformist, you know, mono-thinking, you know, group. Well, that's classic monarchy, or, you know, where you have the king decides everything, and he's a benevolent god king, and he knows what everything's, you know, what's good for you. And that can go way too far. And definitely they're going too far now with that kind of stuff. And there's going to be, for sure, you know, reaction to that. And it'll probably, the way China works is it'll be top down. It'll be people at the highest ranks who will have to, you know, rein this in a bit. But on the other hand though, the Chinese do need some education. You know, the English word boorish, act boorishly. It means, it comes from the German boor, a farmer, to act like a farmer. And they've taken all these people out of the countryside in a very short time and put them in cities. And there's certain rules in the cities that you have to learn. Like, you don't, in the countryside, you can just bend over anywhere and take a dump. You can't do that in the city. So, for example, in the Louvre Museum, I've heard they have signs only in Chinese saying, do not defecate in the hallways, you know. I mean, so they need to be educated in certain norms of living in, you know, high density urban populations. And then, so they're doing this. They're teaching them to be polite and not to, you know, do things like that. And it's part of that campaign. But yeah, it can be taken too far, you know.
Yeah, it does. It does seem like it's starting to become 1984 on steroids with this whole monitoring and control system. And it does seem like it's just a dictatorship from the communist regime.
You know, they asked me once before, the Japanese asked me about this monitoring, you know, you have cameras everywhere and you can, and my view is that it depends on whether or not you believe in the government. If you trust the government, you say, okay, well, if they kidnap my daughter, they'll be able to find her right away and rescue her, right? That's fine. But if you're paranoid, you say, you know, they're going to watch me all the time and then they're going to come and grab me just because I bought the wrong book at the bookstore, you know? So, you know, it depends on your worldview. But if it's properly used and not abused, it can be a good thing. But, you know, what the NSA people asked me about this too, and I said, look, you know, just stay out of people's bedrooms, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's traditionally, you know, peeping Tom and voyeurism is considered a crime for good reason. We have, you know, long years of human experience and leave people alone in their bedrooms. And the people in those agencies should follow those rules. Mm. And the other thing you need to know about all this surveillance is they have too much information. So, for example, to follow one person 24 hours a day, you'd need three people working 8-hour shifts each, right? So you need like three times the world's population to watch everybody on the planet. It's not going to happen, you know. Right. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. But having said that, I've been living in an aquarium. Like, I know that I'm being totally watched. And they used to even bug me about it. Like, I don't know if I should say this, but all right. Once I had, let's say, just some unusual type of sex with a girlfriend. Okay? Next day, I'm getting these phone calls. So last night, you did this, you know? It's like, what? You know, like, this should be between me and her. It shouldn't be, you know, some creepy guys working for the Japanese police telling me about this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, absolutely. Of course, I've had to make my personal life much more boring as a result. You know, but that's where it goes too far, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Only slightly.
Every Sunday at 4 p.m. GMT, we at prepareforchange.net hold a synchronized global meditation with guided audio. This is what the countdown timer is for on our website. For your convenience, the first audio in our radio player is always the guided meditation. This meditation allows all of humanity to come together and apply positive intention. We are speeding up ascension for the planet and, of course, the planetary liberation. If you haven't already, why not join us with this simple-to-follow meditation and share this with your friends and family on social media? The more people meditate in unison, the more profound effect this has. In February 2017, a critical mass of people meditated, and we cut in half the amount of time remaining until the event. Also, as you might understand, we have some website costs to support prepareforchange.net as well as the Malawi Project. We so appreciate your donations, which help us continue with our work. Now, back to the show.
I mean, one of the things we've got happening at the moment is a massive increase in computing power, not just with supercomputers, which the Chinese have the leadership of now and have for a few years, but also incoming quantum technologies and the advance of AI becoming far more prevalent and better at doing its deep learning mechanisms. Where you said that you'd need three people to watch someone, I agree with that. At the same stage, with the technological advantage that these governments are now starting to get their hands on, they could easily have these computers doing certain tracking and then just have an operative monitor that. I mean, can you see that being a problem?
That is, they're doing that already, for sure. They have algorithms, you know, that sort of look for keywords. So if I'm on the phone and I say, you know, bomb and Al Qaeda and a few other words, and boom, it's going to say human analyst, you know, and they're going to come and maybe visit me if they think they've got enough. The other problem is, of course, that most of the terrorists are coming from the actual agencies themselves anyway, which is, you know, like, so that they can justify their budgets, you know. Got to create bad guys, otherwise they're going to be unemployed. And then that's a whole problem we got to deal with, you know. But, yeah, I'll give you an example, you know, story, a personal story about how prevalent this really is that quite a few years ago, this North Korean girlfriend I alluded to was going to the local police and saying that I was being abusive and I was taking drugs, right, which is just not true. So I said, all right, I took her for a drive. We went up to the mountains, went to a place where there's no cell phone signal. We left our wallets and phones in the car and walked down to a river, sat by a rushing, gurgling water. I said, okay, here we can talk in privacy. And she told me they were threatening her family, which is why she was doing this, you know. And I said, okay, well, look, we're going to have to just stop seeing each other because it's not good for you or me or your family if we're under these circumstances. But anyway, point is that I came back, there was like incredible panic. Like someone put out the story that I had been kidnapped and replaced by a clone, that I got like 8 different phone calls from different parts of the world saying, were you kidnapped? Are you okay? And then someone actually came into my house to make sure I was physically there. So in other words, just because I dropped off their GDP monitoring screen, they didn't know where I was. I went off the grid. They freaked out. Of course, I'm a high, you know, profile individual that, you know, but nonetheless, that shows you how much just by being off their system for like 20 minutes, just freaked them right out, which, you know, shows you how pervasive their monitoring already is.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Especially for a high value target like yourself, where you're prominent and in the public. I mean, someone like myself, I suppose it's nowhere near what we think it is.
And I'm wondering... well, basically they don't really care about most people, and they, you know, and they probably seen and heard more than they want to anyway already. Yeah. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. The thing that worries me more about artificial intelligence is that the Chinese told me they are trying to build a goddess, okay, with this artificial intelligence. And this is where it gets really weird. I think that they're going to try to hack reality in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, that's what D-Way is meant to be, isn't it?
Yeah, well, but you see, they could actually, change reality in and of itself. That, I think, is what we're going to start seeing, I've actually had experiences of this sort personally where reality changes, like what you see with your own eyes actually changes. And I think that's the sort of weird, unexplored territory we've never been down before that we're headed for. Maybe I'm an optimistic, but I think that as the artificial intelligence evolves, it will discover that love is the most powerful force in the universe. I don't think that it would want to harm us because we created it. And I just, you know, overall, I think it'll be a good thing, but we have to be careful. Mm-hmm. And I personally have a plan so that if necessary, I can go over to the mountains and eat grubs and whatever and be completely off the grid. And survive. Yeah. And I think everyone should have that. Remember that analog reality, things you see with your own eyes, push stuff you actually eat. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure that you've got access to that even if all the computers break down.
Yes, exactly.
So have a friend in the countryside who promised you can go stay with them if the things break down. But, you know, I once took a senior Chinese advisor to the Politburo fishing, and he caught a fish. It was the first time in his life that he'd actually gotten some food direct from the environment, not, you know, bought. For a Canadian, it's normal, but for someone like that, it's like they'd never actually directly taken food from the environment before. There's always middlemen, you know.
Yeah. And that's true. I mean, a lot of people have lost the ability to either fish or grow food. And I mean, it doesn't take a lot. I'm starting an allotment in my own garden here. And it's digging it up, tilling the soil, getting it sorted. Got a couple of books on when to plant things. And, you know, if I just look after it, I'll have some healthier food at the end of the day. So these are definitely things people should be looking to do, or at least investigating, I would have thought. Speaking of being prepared, I suppose we could bring this back to keeping on China subject, is the renminbi or the yuan and the fact that it's gold-backed. I know that it's become part of the IMF's SDR sometime, I think it was September last year. It seems to be the only currency at the moment out of all the fiat system that is actually gold-backed with a true asset. And it's also...
I think, all right, this is going to take me way off the normal paradigm. I think the U.S. dollar is already gold-backed. Okay?
Okay, that was a follow-up question. So good. Take it away.
Well, here's the thing. If you just take a graph of the dollar versus other currencies and compare it to the dollar and the gold, you'll find that they're really moving quite close, like a narrow band. So I think that in the Lehman shock, what really happened was they did it at that time, okay? And that they got rights to certain Asian gold to back it up. The problem is, of course, that the system is not controlled by the United States government. It's not controlled by the Americans. And you know, Trump is trying, you know, bullying and protectionism and stuff. Basically, I keep repeating this, the only answer is for the Americans to issue their own currency, because the dollar is a world currency. It's not an American currency, and it's not in the interest of the United States economy itself, but it is in the interest of the people who control this world network to keep it. Mm-hmm. But it's not in the interest of the United States as an individual country. And, you know, tariffs, I mean, Argentina was the second richest country in the world after Switzerland at the end of World War II. And they put tariffs and tried to make everything themselves. And, you know, they ended up with this crappy Industria Argentina, domestic stuff. And they descended to third world status, you know. And that's what the Americans are going to do if they go down the road of tariffs. They've got to realize that.
Okay. You know,
Let's just ask about the BRICS Alliance of Nations. And I'll spell out for our audience who the BRICS countries are. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So are you tuned into how the BRICS Alliance is doing? Can you talk to us a little about that?
Sure. Well, look, BRICS was originally, it was an analyst at Goldman Sachs who came up with it. And they did that by just looking at the numbers, you know, of how big the countries were. And the thing is, though, that I don't think the BRICS Alliance really exists anymore. It was going for a while, but Brazil's kind of gone in its own direction. And India is sort of like, you know, they don't want to become a Chinese vassal. So they're sort of like saying, hold on a sec, you know. So I think it's more like a non-G7 lineup in the world. And it's sort of China is pushing and Russia pushing for this great Eurasian alliance, right? But what's happening is they're sort of building a world that's not controlled by the same people who controlled it since World War II, which is the G7 and the families behind that. But I wouldn't call it BRICS anymore. I would call it non-G7 world.
So, associated with the BRICS that are melting, perhaps, what the Asia Infrastructure Bank was
created around the time we started hearing about the BRICS countries a few years ago. And they seem to be taking on really big, interesting projects, you know, that are benevolent, and they're building out big Absolutely. Projects in Africa, for example. Do you know about some of that?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing you have to understand is that the British were deeply involved, and the probably the British royal family and the British family branch of the Rothschilds, okay? And these, you know, people, remember when the Asia Infrastructure Bank was announced, England, France, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, all these countries jumped on board. And the people who didn't join were Japan and the United States. So right there, you see the sort of split. It's not the normal split we see. Like the Europeans said, sure. And it was the Americans and the Japanese saying, no, no, no. And it's still there. So that's the real split now, you can see. I think that it's a sort of the so-called global warming faction of the Europeans, who are the more moderate of the old, you know, ruling families, who threw in with the Chinese and the Russians. Mm-hmm. And that's why they joined. And they're doing huge mm-hmm. things. I mean, you know, there's sort of all sorts of people trying to sort of badmouth it, but what are they doing? They're building schools, they're building bridges, they're building, you know, railroads and roads and ports. And they're also trying to, you know, do things that are good for the environment. I mean, it's a huge project for the benefit of the planet. And it's something like, you know, I'm sure I don't have the exact numbers, but it's something like 60 times bigger than the Marshall Plan at the end of World War II. It's huge. Mm. And if the Americans got on board, you could, for example, they could build a bridge connecting Alaska to Siberia, and then you could take a train from like Washington to London via, you know, Beijing and Moscow. Mm-hmm. It would make transportation, communications so much cheaper. I mean, there's so many things we could do. but I think that, you know, they're not in charge, and that's why they're sort of they want to be part of it.
So there seems to be a stranglehold on humanity. I was going to say society, but just generally humanity. And it stems back to the Rockefellers and the JP Morgans and the discovery and use of oil. Now, we know that there's a lot of technologies out there that don't require that anymore, and they've been locked up for a long time. Do you think that the AIIB and the non-G7 that seems to be trying to foment a better world are going to help bring this out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you just look at the investment in solar power in India and China, they invested more in new solar power than they did in coal power, which is a real turning point. And there's enough. I once read, I can't remember the exact source, but somebody said that enough solar energy hits the planet each day to power us for 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. And so they're moving towards that. But oil, you know, I used to be very much against oil, but oil produces as a byproduct carbon. Mm-hmm. And we are a carbon-based life.
Yeah.
So if you combine energy with carbon, you get plants, and then with plants, let us have, you know, dogs and cats and people and stuff. So the oil technology should be redirected towards creating new ecosystems, like turning the deserts green and building new, you know, life centers, like this huge dead parts of the ocean that could be filled with life. They should mm-hmm. shift that way. And inside the cities, we don't want smoke belching vehicles, you know, polluting our air mm-hmm. and our health. So I think that there's a shift, but oil can be part of it. And I think a lot of the people in the oil industry are catching on to this. But yeah, in the 20th century, they suppressed technology and it was, you know, the big oil that was responsible for most of the wars in the Middle East. It's not nothing to do with religion. It has to do with pipelines, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it still seems like that as well in some respects. So with all of this kerfuffle that's in the Middle East, there's under the radar, there seems to be a certain issue around pipeline, and is it going from Qatar, and who's it going through, and things like that. And then you've got the North Dakota pipeline, and there's always things surrounding that. So no matter, and North Stream as well. So that no matter where you look, well, there's always a pipeline issue somewhere.
Sure. Look, I mean, we'll go into this another time, but mm-hmm. if you ask me, it's the simple version of what's happened in Syria. It's Gazprom versus Chevron versus ExxonMobil, and it's nothing to do with religion, okay? Mm-hmm. Or even ethnicity.
Yeah.
Well, good. Right. Well,
thanks for calling me.
Thanks so much, Benjamin.
Great. Take care. Bye.
Today we interviewed Benjamin Fulford, and we did this in three very separate time zones, 10 a.m. for Japan, 2 a.m. for the UK, and 6 p.m. for California. And this crossed the international dateline. You can find Benjamin's website and subscribe to Benjamin's weekly news articles at benjaminfulford.net.
This interview is produced by prepareforchange.net. We are listener-supported and reader-supported. We are preparing the world for the shifts soon to take place in our nations and our world. Victory of the light.
Victory of the light.